To begin what we want to share with you today, I'd like to take you along with me briefly on an experience that I had very soon after we began our time in Jerusalem. And I can explain a little bit later some of the finer points of why I was doing what I was doing. I received a call to go to a very small village in the West Bank called Yenoun. And the reason that I was called to go there was because we have people working with a program of the World Council of Churches who are always there, but every now and then the particular team that is there, some of the people have to go out for something. In this case, there were three people in the team. One of the people had a medical appointment that they had to go out for. Another person wanted the opportunity, as it was a weekend, to go into Jerusalem to go to church and to see some friends for a break. The third person was able to stay there and was glad to stay there. Her name was Rachel. She was actually the first Jewish program in this program. There have been others since. She was from Britain, and she could not stay in the community without another international with her by the regulations of the program. So this was basically almost the first thing that I did in my role in Israel and Palestine. And this involved taking a bus and then taking an even smaller bus and then meeting a gentleman who had a car who drove me partway and then finally walking into this village. This was just after Christmas. It was extremely cold. This is something that we don't always think about in the Middle East. In the winter, in many of the areas, especially the hilly areas, it gets very cold, and they can get snow in this village. And so I walked in, and I met Rachel, and I met many of the villagers, and was immediately taken to tea and food and whatnot, and we settled in under many blankets for the evening. Later, we met with the school children. We talked to the farmers about their sheep and their crops, and we ran around and generally were accompanying these people in their daily life. Why were we doing this, and why did Rachel have to stay there? Because this small, beautiful, simple village is surrounded on three sides by hills, and on each of the points of these hills all around them were what are called outposts of Israeli settlements. And you will have heard things in the news about settlements. Outposts tend to be established by people who are extremely dedicated to the idea that they should be taking over Palestinian land. And the people in this village had been driven out of the village several years before by settlers who polluted their well and burned down parts of the village and terrorized them generally, and were only able to return because other people accompanied them. They're pleased to say that the first group that accompanied them were people from an Israeli peace group called Tayush, but there have been many people since then. But my first experience of living in Israel-Palestine and being with people there was of this village being overlooked by people who had many, many weapons, who had huge searchlights that they shone on the village all night long, people with binoculars who were watching our every move. So that the first thing that I encountered in that role that I was sent to do was a sense of both fear and the importance of solidarity with people. These people were able to stay in this village because they knew that they would not be forgotten. And Rachel was a living example of this for them. We're very gratified that Anthony had invited us to speak to you this morning, and it's our great privilege to serve the United Church's overseas personnel. it's our great responsibility to share what our partners want us to tell you. We do this because of your M&S givings, as Anthony said, and more than the fact that you give money, M&S is a way that we see you sharing what we're doing, that we're doing this on your behalf and knowing that your prayers and support go with us, so that in a very, very clear way, you are a part of this witness.
The text that Anthony read this morning couldn't be more dramatic. Imagine Jesus, just in viewing the city of Jerusalem, reduced to tears because people could not recognize peace if they saw it. Confusing the peace offered by Rome with the real peace offered by God. A kind of stable security. If you let the soldiers impose tranquility, that's the peace you get. And then just before, people have been shouting out for more freedom, and Jesus says, but if they were to be silent, the stones would shout out. Well, 1 year and 3 months ago, after over 60 years of dispossession in 1948, and after over 40 years of an ongoing violent and humiliating repressive military occupation, Christians in Palestine have cried out like the stones. Speaking as Christians, but speaking to the reality of all Palestinians, Christians and Muslims. They started a new movement and issued a cry of hope in what they see as a hopeless situation. That cry was called Kairos, Palestine. This document's available, and I hope people will read it and study it. And the sharing that Susan and I are going to do will be unusual, because we are trying to privilege without filters, without an imposed sense of saying, no, don't say it that way, say it this way, what Palestinian Christians have felt they have not been heard in saying, oh, these many years. They say they cry out from the heart of Palestinian suffering to speak a word of truth, and that their truth is grounded in faith, hope, and love. And I tell you the truth from my point of view. This is one of the most profound theological statements in recent history. It speaks of a point of view that is seldom heard. By actual count of an international research group that looked at all the coverage that had been happening over the last 15 years about the Palestinian-Israeli situation, they found that only 4% of any kind of reporting, radio, television, internet, ever mentioned the word occupation. This word of a people's experience living under military occupation is seldom heard. And it's a burden for us. And I say that without trying to get your sympathy. Fact of the matter is, when we try and tell the story of the people that we work with, we're often shouted down, called anti-Semites, told we don't really want to listen to the whole story. And we feel this burden to share it with you today. They began their statement echoing Jesus in a different way, saying, peace, peace, where there is no peace, as Jeremiah said. We have now years and years of a peace process. The more there was a peace process, the more there were settlements, which means Israelis building colonies on Palestinian land, doubled over the whole period of the peace process. The period they were supposed to give more land to Palestinians gave more land to Israelis. 500,000 settlers today. 500,000 settlers. A wall that supposedly was to protect Israelis, but built on Palestinian land that happened to cut off many, many, many thousands, tens of thousands of square miles of their own agricultural land, the water sources, and so on. In the name of security, but in fact, nothing more or less than a land grab, and to establish borders by fiat rather than through negotiation. We talked about it with the kids. They talk about all the things, and I won't have a time to tell all the things because these are vignettes. The mechanisms of the occupation works by stopping Palestinians going between their own villages. It's said these checkpoints are to provide security for Israelis, But Susan and I walked every day in a situation where the basic point of over 560 roadblocks and closures was to stop Palestinians going from each other's villages, cutting people off from their relatives in Jerusalem, cutting people off from medical care, their jobs and hospitals. Can you imagine sitting in a church as we did on Sunday, listening to the agony of a parent who had to send their children on their own for cancer treatment because the child could get a permit, but they couldn't? These arbitrary laws are contrary to international law, and they are finally calling out and saying, we will say the word military occupation. We will say what it means for our people. We will say what happened in Gaza when 1.5 million people have been reduced to living in inhumane conditions in what is now called the world's largest open-air prison, where entry and exit by air, land, or sea is prohibited, where ordinary things for the stuff of life are not allowed to enter except under a very arbitrary list because supposedly there is security embargoes. An avocado can come in, but chickpeas can't. We speak passionately about this because the Christian leaders have cried out, and they have talked about Jerusalem also as being at the heart of their suffering. This is the reality of military occupation. A city that should be for all people has been restricted to a city of discrimination and exclusion. So I finish here, as Susan and I will trade back and forth, with saying, theologically, they ground this call in an understanding, first of all, that occupation is a sin against God and humanity. But secondly, they ground it profoundly in the call to love and understand that as they confront the situation that is gripping them, that call to love means that they will not hate those that impose things on them, but understand the very violence they're victims to only has one solution: nonviolent resistance to evil that removes the occupation so that what can be freed are both the Israelis and the Palestinians. Their firm belief is that the root cause of the current situation is that the occupation has itself generated violence, and if removed, there would be a possibility of a new day, as they call it, where there would be peace and security for both peoples. A resistance based on the logic of love overcoming evil, not hating people who are created in God's image, as we all are.
Well, like anyone who works closely with our United Church partners overseas, we have a lot of experiences to share and a lot of things to share from those partners. And we should probably underline that we were called to work there through the World Council of Churches, primarily doing this through Palestinian Christian partners and Israeli peace groups who are also working in partnership with the United Church and other churches. Because this is a complex situation and because of the inaccurate reporting that was referred to in the prayer of confession, we find there are a lot of questions that people want to ask, and we look forward to talking with as many of you as possible after the service. But our main concern here is to lift up what people are doing there and what they're saying to us. And I, in the middle of a military occupation, which is increasing in severity and controlling all parts of the lives of the people who live there. We were privileged to be there because of two different initiatives through the World Council of Churches, using your mission and service dollars, that really were part of the hope that people are looking for in a situation of hopelessness after these 60 years. The first one and the program that Chris worked closely with was the bringing together of people and especially leaders of the 13 historic churches that are in Jerusalem to work together in what is now called the Jerusalem Interchurch Center and to focus their ability to act and come together and to speak to the rest of the world. And this has had been part of a larger process, which has also produced the Kairos Palestine document, which is a strong word directly from those Christians. The program that I referred to very briefly earlier, the Ecumenical Accompaniment Program in Palestine and Israel, started in the most difficult days of the Second Intifada, when Palestinian Christians were suffering under curfews, along with their Muslim brothers and sisters, when there were killings and imprisonments and many things happening and the world was not paying attention. They called out to the international Christian community and said, "We need your help." The response, the Ecumenical Accompaniment Program, sends people now from a total of, I believe it's 17 different countries. And these people go for a 3-month period to work in teams in both sites in Palestine, but also in Jerusalem, working with Israeli groups, in order to accompany people, in order to do monitoring of human rights situations, in order to foster various kinds of conduct. And one of their important witnesses is to go back to the countries that they come from and work on advocacy there. I'll just say very briefly that a United Church person from here in Ottawa has been there on two different occasions, once far into the West Bank, and her second appointment was in Bethlehem, where she participated in, among other things, the human rights monitoring of the access that people have to try and get through the barrier of the wall to get to places that they need to go to in Jerusalem. So the Ecumenical Accompaniment Program is one example of how internationals can respond. But I would want to leave you in my time with just one sort of picture. In the midst of all this and through all this, the Palestinian people and their Israeli brothers and sisters who are concerned about ending the occupation have never stopped hoping and working for this. Almost the vast, overwhelming majority of Palestinians are in favor of nonviolent means of trying to resist the occupation. And a very important and wonderful Quaker woman, Palestinian Quaker woman named Jean Zaru, says when she's asked about how people can act nonviolently, says, "We get up in the morning, we go out of our houses, we act in responsible ways according to what calls us to do, and our witness, our the way we live our lives is a nonviolent testament to how we think the world should be."
I once heard a story about Anthony Bailey that told me that he had a long sermon prepared and was already over time, but he decided to keep going. We will indulge in your time to say one more thing. The reading from Isaiah that we heard today is really startling. Do you remember that bit? It's actually very dramatic. It says that that truth is really cast aside. Justice is far away. The situation is awful. And worse, when people try and do something about it, they themselves are persecuted. And it says something that we all know, which is, when God saw that, God was displeased. Does that surprise anybody here to hear that God is displeased about injustice? No. But it says more. It says, when God was displeased, then God saw that no one was willing to intervene to change the injustice. And you know how God was then? Not displeased, which was a light word in Hebrew, was appalled. Literally, it made God sick. God couldn't stand it. It was overwhelming for God to look at the creation and history and see that in the midst of injustice, which does happen, people let it happen. That when truth wasn't being told, no one stood up. Well, I'm pleased to say that our Palestinian Christian partners are not willing to be the kind of Christians that appall God. They're needing to stand up and to meet this nonviolent call. And they are doing it in two ways that are models for us, besides, as Susan mentioned. One is, they start with confession and purification. They don't say, those awful Israelis. They say, how have we failed to be faithful to God in this context? What are the opportunities? Where have we not chosen all the opportunities that are our disposal, that are nonviolent, and that are based on love and dignifying the other? And the answer they came with after confession purification is, we can use our economic power as ordinary citizens. When I go and buy something, I can choose to not buy Israeli goods, because a lot of those goods profit the settlements, these things that are imposed. They help build that wall. They help oppress my people. So me, as a Palestinian, I'm not going to cooperate with an economy that is killing our people. And so they thought those kinds of ways. People say, boycotts are terrible. They say, maybe terrible. Show me another way. And they're inviting us to do the same thing. On close examination, not exactly the same thing, but to ask the same question. What would be for us the nonviolent way of not simply saying this situation is too complicated? And by the way, I want to make a quick parenthesis and ending. We are clear, Susan and I, in the United Church of Canada, the World Council of Churches, that Israel has a right to exist as a state in full peace and security with internationally recognized borders. But we are also clear that most of what passes as self-defense is not. And that we must hold Israel like any other state, like I'm trying to do today in the letters that I write and the actions that I take in all the states of the world to high standards of human rights. Not treating Israel differently at all, but treating them simply the same. In that affirmation, we should look at, each of us, what are the nonviolent ways? Economic boycott. What goods do we buy or not buy? What stocks do we invest or not invest in them? The question should be asked so that we also are not find ourselves in a theologically, to play on words, appalling situation. We can be uplifted today by these tough and sad stories, like I said to kids, because the affirmation of this is they say there is no positive expectation. They look and they don't see things are likely to change. But they have hope because they know something very fundamental. And Anthony said it in his prayer. The future is still open. The world of justice will be if we choose for it to be. We can make a choice to respond to faith and hope in the logic of love so that everyone, Israeli, Palestinian, Jew, Christian, Muslim, can sit under their vine and fig tree and live in peace and unafraid. Amen.